What's the best video on the internet? The best one. When people ask me this question, I always go for this one from the 2016 Libertarian presidential debates.
Should someone have to have a government-issued license to drive a car?
Hell no.
What's next? Requiring a license to make toast in your own damn toaster?
The license to drive? You know, I'd like to see some competency exhibited by people before they drive.
I don't mind libertarians. I know some smart people who are libertarians, but come on! I love this video so much that whenever I hear anyone say, "Hell no!" I mentally autocomplete, "What's next? Requiring a license to cook toast in your own damn toaster?" Is this the best video on the internet? It's a classic, but if you ask enough people, I'm reasonably confident that one of the top candidates will be a video so indelibly stamped into the cultural memory of the internet that it's been a meme for over 15 years, possibly beating out even Rick Astley as the longest-lasting meme that's never become dated. You know him, you love him, get your hands off his penis.
Just, but you just assured me that I could speak.
Sit down inside the car.
You're
not assuring anything.
We're
under arrest.
Look, I'm under what? Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest. Have a look at the headlock here. See that chap over there? Get your hand off my penis! This is the bloke who got me on the penis before.
Get some cuffs.
Why did you do this to me?
In the car.
Get some cuffs.
For what reason? What is the charge? Eating a meal? A succulent Chinese meal? Oh, that's a nice headlock, sir.
Oh,
yes. I see that you know your judo well. Good one. And you, sir, are you waiting to receive my limp penis? How dare get your hands off me.
But wait, do you know him? If you've ever owned a Wi-Fi compatible device, you've seen this video. But for how well known this video is, there's a lot that isn't well known about it. Who is this man? And why is he being arrested? For years, as this video made the rounds, nobody knew the answer to either of these questions. People assumed that he was being arrested for dining and dashing, much in the way that people just assumed Humpty Dumpty was an anthropomorphic egg. If you inform people that nothing in the original video directly confirms this, they'll be surprised. But yeah, all it suggests that is that he asks if he's being arrested for eating a meal. A succulent Chinese meal! Which got people attempting to find the guy's identity to search for records of arrests in Australia, where the video is known to have originated, for dining and dashing. This led to the first theory of the guy's identity, that the man in the video was Paul Charles Dosa, a Hungarian chess master who moved to Australia in the 60s. This theory is incredibly flimsy for a lot of reasons, not least that our guy clearly does not have a Hungarian accent, but I think people glommed onto this theory because it was just so fun. Paul Charles Dosa was one hell of a character. He was a compulsive diner and dasher, allegedly arrested over 100 times all over the world for staying and dining in 5-star hotels, complimenting the food and demonstrating his detailed knowledge of high cuisine and wine, and then skipping out without paying. Dosa was described by people who knew him through the chess world as a con artist who wore expensive suits and claimed descent from Hungarian nobility. Once, after refusing to pay for a $119 Australian meal, he purportedly called the cops on himself, with the claimed motive of getting himself listed in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most arrests for dining and dashing. Dosa was wanted by Interpol and the governments of at least 4 countries, and by the time he was reported dead in 2003, he used so many aliases that neither the police nor his friends believed he had really died. He also has an archived GeoCities page that suggests he was probably schizophrenic, and also confirms something we kinda already knew, that despite having probably been arrested for eating a succulent Chinese meal at some point, he is not the protagonist of the legendary video. I'd love to go further down the Paul Dosa rabbit hole, but he's not our guy. So who is? One thing worth noting is that while this video is definitely from Australia, the cops in the video clearly have Aussie accents, and sharp-eyed viewers further narrowed down the origin to Brisbane from the cops' uniforms, not only does our hero not have a Hungarian accent, that's not an Australian accent either. That's like a Masterpiece Theatre upper-class British accent. Another theory speculated that it was the London-born Australian politician John Bartlett, who supposedly looks like our guy. I don't see it, but I have prosopagnosia, so what do I know? This was also a flimsy theory that's fun to believe. Aussies seem to love making up embarrassing restaurant-related stories about their politicians. I was gonna say, this is, after all, a country where Scott Morrison, the future Prime Minister, once shat himself in a McDonald's, but I looked that up and found that it's a myth. There is a plaque at that McDonald's commemorating the rumor, though. Getting back on topic, a prevailing theory had become that the video was staged. Why was it shot from multiple angles? Completely apart from the guy's stentorian speaking style and incredibly quotable retorts, why was the audio quality, specifically for Mr. Succulent, so good? People began to believe that it was a reenactment of one of Paul Dosa's arrests, with an actor for a news broadcast about him, but no TV news report about the exploits of Paul Dosa ever surfaced. And then, in 2020, the man in the video came forward at last, and his story was wilder than anyone could have imagined. Buckle the fuck up. As far as I know, even though approximately everyone on Earth knows his face and his voice, the full story behind Mr. Jack Carlson and his succulent Chinese meal has never been told on YouTube before, and it involves Nazis, daring jailbreaks, prison playwrights, and the Australian equivalent of Charles Manson. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. In March 2020, the Australian punk band The Chats released a music video for a song called Dine and Dash. I wanna go out and fill my gob, but I don't have a fucking job. I can't afford a proper fee. I just wish I could eat. Somehow, they got the original guy to feature at the beginning of the video, doing an enfeebled but unmistakable impression of his 69 seconds of fame.
Gentlemen, this is democracy manifest. Ta-ta and farewell.
The media still had no idea who he was, reporting his name in connection with the Chats video as Paul Charles Dosa. Then the real guy came forward and began doing the press circuit, proving much more convincingly that he was Mr. Democracy Manifest.
We're supposed to be living in a democracy, and here they're dragging me out of a restaurant after enjoying halfway through a succulent Chinese meal. That's what I thought. Well, gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
His name was either Jack Carlson or Cecil George Edwards, both of which he'd gone by for large parts of his life. It seemed he was a friendly, elderly, mild-mannered artist, living out in rural Queensland, the state where Brisbane is the capital, painting pictures, many of which depicted his arrest. As his paintings, and the fact that they regularly sold for hundreds of dollars, suggest, he was locally known in Queensland as the succulent Chinese meal guy, long before his identity was public on the internet. Which makes me wonder what other iconic internet mysteries have an answer sitting there in plain sight if you just ask the right people. But once Carlson's identity hit the headlines, journalists discovered that the story of his arrest was murky, and acquired a bit of a Rashomon effect, since nobody involved, not the cops, not the TV news crew, nor Carlson himself, expected that day to be remembered decades later by millions of people. For the cops, arresting an unruly drunk guy was Tuesday. For the news crew, covering an arrest was Tuesday. For Jack Carlson, as we will see, getting arrested on unclear charges and theatrically making a scene of it was Tuesday. Most of the people involved in that video have surfaced since Carlson did, but their stories contradict, and even to this day, it's not universally agreed upon why he was being arrested or why a whole TV crew was set up to film the arrest from multiple angles. Here's what I've gathered to be the most accurate story, I think. That fateful day, October 11th, 1991, which was actually a Friday, Carlson had used a credit card at his favorite Greasy Spoon Chinese restaurant in suburban Brisbane. The card rang up under a name other than the one he usually gave to the restaurant staff. Meanwhile, some other regular customer of the restaurant, unidentified to this day, had been using a stolen American Express card for the past several weeks, including many times at that restaurant. It just so happened that around lunchtime on that Friday, a private fraud investigator from American Express walked into the restaurant expecting that the staff would know about any regular customer who seemed suspicious. Carlson was there, eating a succulent Chinese meal, as he often did, and because of his use of aliases, a waiter told the investigator that Carlson must be the guy he's looking for. Then, in order to get the police down there as quickly as possible, the investigator called the cops and announced, with no evidence to back up this claim, that one of Queensland's most wanted was in the restaurant. Someone from the Queensland State Police Fraud Squad tipped off the 7 News crime reporter Chris Reason, who rushed a camera crew down to that restaurant to catch what seemed like it was going to be a big arrest. The original narration, removed from the video that was later uploaded to YouTube, described the arrest as a case of mistaken identity, since he certainly wasn't one of Queensland's most wanted. Turns out, by then at least, Carlson was just a weirdo with a lot of aliases. He was no big shot criminal, but he did know his prisons well. Much later, he claimed that he made a scene so that he would be seen as a crazy person placed in a mental hospital rather than a prison, since those are easier to escape from. He would know. Sure enough, while Carlson was not put in a mental hospital, he was kept overnight at the central jail in Brisbane, only to be nowhere to be found in the morning. Police speculated that he had conned a guard into thinking he was to be released on bail. From then on, they couldn't track him down any better than the internet could, since he had given his name as Cecil George Edwards, his birth name, and by then, in his daily life, he only ever went by Jack Carlson. Besides, the cops thought he'd probably been framed for credit card fraud by the American Express investigator, so who cared? But Carlson's record was not remotely clean, and being arrested seemingly just for having a suspiciously shifting identity, denouncing his captors in a booming voice, and then escaping from where he was temporarily being kept and disappearing for decades, was the most Jack Carlson thing ever. Most of this video is sourced from the work of Mark Dappin, a true crime reporter who wrote a book called Carnage, A Succulent Chinese Meal, Mr. Rent-A-Kill, and the Australian Manson Murders. As the title suggests, there is a lot going on under the hood. Long before his shifting aliases caught up to him over a succulent Chinese meal, Carlson was a member of an Australian criminal underworld that I found shocking in both its brutality and its pettiness. Yes, we're getting much darker in this episode than you expected. Dappin's book goes by in a blur of names and crimes, often following thugs whose lives almost never intersected with Carlson's, for several chapters at a time until it finally circles back to Carlson. These people are not really worth dignifying by calling them gangsters. Gangsters have organizational structures. Their crimes are planned for financial gain or at least for revenge. The people in Carlson's orbit called themselves Crims, simply an abbreviation of criminals. They committed crimes for crime's sake. All over this book are stories of random shopkeepers murdered in stick-ups gone wrong, in which the assailant only ever took a few dollars from the till. People get killed or snitched on just for rumors that they're spreading rumors. Other than operating some semi-legal nightclubs and paying cops to look the other way, or even paying them to work as bouncers, these Australian crims didn't involve themselves in drug smuggling or large-scale fraud or any other form of organized crime, nor did they even have gang colors, territory, or symbols. I guess I could call several of the characters Carlson interacted with serial killers. Serial killers kill because they enjoy killing. That seems to be the only motive for a lot of the crimes committed in this book, but I'm used to thinking of serial killers as a solitary bunch. People that fucked up don't often find a community of gregarious friends who are as fucked up as them. Except it seems, for a little while in 1970s Australia. This book is the closest real-life thing I've ever read to the convention of serial killers in the Sandman comics. And yes, I know, Sandman is still good, though. And yet, we don't know that much about the details of these crimes, because the Crims lied, but the cops constantly, systematically lied too. The way Dappin depicts the 1970s Australian justice system really makes me go, now this is a country founded by criminals. I was gobsmacked to learn that this isn't actually the origin of the phrase kangaroo court. In the 1970s in Australia, police would regularly provide confessions known as verbals from accused criminals. A verbal was a transcript drawn up by a police officer in which the accused purportedly confessed to all their alleged crimes, gave a story for what made them do it, and often confessed to whatever other unsolved crimes in the area the cops wanted to close. Confession transcripts were supposed to end with the signature of the accused to prove they were real, but a verbal would always be a transcript of an interview with a surprisingly cooperative criminal who at the end suddenly refused to sign the transcript, claiming some esoteric criminal code of honor. The judges ate it up, even after cops regularly served them the same repetitive stories over and over again. There was practically a Mad Libs format for verbals. For years, until the whole verbal racket was unearthed, the press and the courts in Australia claimed that criminals had a code of honor that prevented them exclusively from signing anything. Because of verbals, and because crims often bragged about committing crimes that they didn't, there's almost nothing about Jack Carlson's wild years that we can say happened for certain. All we have is the series of interviews Carlson did with Mark Dappin in 2021, and if there's one thing we know about Carlson, it's that he's a garrulous storyteller who loves an audience. With that in mind, though, let's get into the long, strange story that ended in the reception of Carlson's limp penis. Jack Carlson was born Cecil George Edwards in Queensland in 1942. He had a rough childhood, raised by a single mother who couldn't afford to raise him and his brother Alan, so from age 7 onward, young Cecil was raised in a series of increasingly abusive orphanages. The culture of the kids in those places was all about how to steal, how to escape, and how to avoid authority. For good reason, since some of those orphanages were investigated for being cruel even by the standards of that era. By Cecil's teens, he had already been arrested for stealing cars and robbing liquor stores. At age 17, he was what was known as a bodgy, which was the Australian equivalent of a 1950s greaser. He began going by Mason. After one brief stint in jail for robbing a convenience store with his bodgy buddies, he adopted the name Jack Carlson, which he went by on and off for the rest of his life. He never explained where this name came from or why he started going by that name. Even then, people who knew him remember him as an identity-shifting performer at heart. In the 1960s, Carlson briefly began following the straight and narrow path, marrying a woman named Margaret and having a daughter, Barbara, in 1965. Not much is known of what became of Barbara. Jack and Monica Carlson ran a pest control business in Mackay, a mid-sized city in northern Queensland. Carlson was never a particularly stable person, though, and not long after the birth of Barbara, he was arrested for being drunk in public, after which his fingerprints were matched to several larger crimes over the previous years, all across eastern Australia. He was incarcerated for 3 months in Brisbane, then transported by rail from there to Maryborough, a small town where he'd once robbed an unspecified business, to stand trial for that crime. On the train to Maryborough, Carlson staged the first of many daring escapes. He had been handcuffed to a cop and another prisoner, going to Maryborough on an unrelated charge, and when the cop fell asleep on the train, he picked the lock on his handcuffs with his belt buckle, slipped away, and jumped off the end of the train as it stopped to let another train pass. A comically easy getaway. He slipped past police roadblocks set up to catch him by giving his name as Jack Carlson and providing appropriate documentation that that was his name, since the name he'd given when he was arrested for public drunkenness was another alias, Helmut Markson, and the authorities later found out that his birth name was Cecil George Edwards, but they didn't know that he now usually went by Jack Carlson. He didn't stay on the straight and narrow path for long. Carlson was then caught, less than a year later, for some fraud scheme with his business, and once again, the authorities discovered a long list of outstanding crimes and escapes on his rap sheet. This time, he was incarcerated down in Victoria, the southernmost state on the Australian mainland, because of a robbery he'd committed in Melbourne. His prison was the McLeod Prison Farm, on a marshy island in a bay south of Melbourne. Not quite an Australian Alcatraz, but close. Nobody had ever successfully escaped from McLeod, until Carlson did, accompanied by an unnamed fellow inmate. Like the train escape, this was not a careful Shawshank Redemption-style escape. The two of them camped in the low brush on the wide flat island for days, uncertain of how they'd get to the mainland, as the guards searched for them with what Carlson later described as a, quote, two-winged aeroplane. What other kinds are there? I mean, I think he meant a biplane, which would have been a real museum beast by 1967 when this took place, but I believe it. What I'm not sure I believe is what allegedly happened next. After days of hiding in the brush, the two of them saw a fishing boat putting in lazy circles off the shore, and at low tide, they waded out to it and asked the person in it, a Scottish fisherman, to take them to the shore. Since he wasn't from around there and didn't know there was a prison on the island, he said, "Sure, laddies." These escapes are incredibly convenient. Then again, there is plenty of documentation on the prison's side of these escapes having taken place, and if Carlson were making up his escapes, I think he'd make himself cleverer and more heroic. But he would get some of those in, too. After Carlson broke out of McLeod, he fell in with an old friend of his named Peter Mond, who lived in a little mountain town west of Sydney. Carlson and Mond committed a series of small-scale break-ins until they were arrested, and at his arraignment hearing, Carlson took his flair for the dramatic to its full potential. Carlson and Mond showed up at their court date on time, Mond dressed in rags, and Carlson in a nice suit. Arraignment is a short, simple procedure compared to a full trial, and several arraignments were being performed one after the other in that courtroom. When Carlson and Mond were booked into the holding cells where they would wait until it was their turn to be arraigned, Carlson instructed the other prisoners to yell at him and call him a cop when it was his turn to come out into the courtroom. Not knowing what was going on, they obliged. When Carlson and Mond's names were called, well-dressed Carlson led shabby-dressed Mond out into the courtroom, accompanied by howls of condemnation from the other prisoners. Carlson introduced himself as plainclothes Detective Rogers and asked, feigning confusion, where Carlson and Mond were supposed to be. The constable overseeing the arraignment was confused as well, and he said he thought the detective would know. Carlson said he didn't, and he was just escorting this other defendant to a different courtroom in the same building. And Carlson dragged Mond right out the door to freedom. This is so brazen that I'm torn between this can't be true and you can't make this shit up. It only took a few more days for Carlson and Mond to end up arrested again, and this time, several cops blocked every possible exit to the courthouse where they were tried. Carlson represented himself, as he always did when he was on trial, loudly and floridly proclaiming his innocence in the style we would all come to know and love. If he'd had a better childhood, perhaps he could have been a lawyer, or at least an actor. As it was, Carlson did begin a creative pursuit after he was sentenced in mid-1968 to 8 years in Long Bay Prison in Sydney. Once he was inside, he kept on working on ways to escape, but not while the infamous magistrate Murray Farquhar was visiting. As a known troublemaker and escape artist, Carlson was terrified that Farquhar would move him to the more abusive, higher security Grafton Prison. So Carlson had to make a good impact on Farquhar. Hearing that the magistrate loved art, Carlson asked a guard to put an easel and paints in his cell, and, not seeing any way those could be used in an escape, the guard obliged. Carlson told Farquhar that he'd begun to paint while incarcerated, and it had turned his life around, which the stern magistrate accepted. Once Farquhar left, though, Carlson still had all the art supplies, so he decided to actually start painting, and it turned out, to his surprise, that he really was good at it and liked it. After a year in Long Bay, Carlson was transferred to Parramatta, another jail in the Sydney area, where he met Jim McNeil. Behind bars for a series of armed robberies, but no colorful escapes to his name, McNeil was nonetheless every bit as much a character. He was extremely smart and loved poetry, politics, and philosophy. He and Carlson started a debate club at the prison that would invite Sydney University students to come discuss weighty issues with them. By now it was the early 70s, and the wave of campus radicalism from around that time was in full swing. Plenty of college students signed up to visit the prison with the expectation that the prisoners would fit their stereotypes of noble victims oppressed by a cruel carceral state. Carlson and McNeil pretty much did, but the prisoners at large preferred to debate topics like Hitler was good, actually. Much disillusionment was had. Around this time, Carlson, now nicknamed the Hun, also became a legend behind the walls of Parramatta for making Pruno, a disgusting moonshine brewed by fermenting yeast, raisins, and sometimes fig jam from the cafeteria kitchen, hidden in socks. Quoth Carlson, "It was horrible, but it got you drunk." Carlson also became known as Parramatta's artist in residence, painting portraits of some of Australia's most notable criminals, which many of them kept once they were released. McNeil, meanwhile, began writing plays, all of which were set in prison, and included characters based on Carlson and his other cellmates. McNeil's plays turned out to be good enough, and easy enough to put on, considering that they all took place in a single prison cell, that he gained some genuine recognition in the theater world as Australia's prison playwright. When they were both transferred to another prison, Carlson and McNeil began putting on plays, both theirs and others, under the name the Mess Hall Players, and were even allowed out on supervised release to perform in theater festivals. One of the plays at the prison, which curious outsiders were allowed to come watch as well, was used as a diversion for two prisoners to escape by clinging to the underside of a van leaving, but that didn't seem to be McNeil and Carlson's main motive for putting on plays. McNeil was released in 1974. Into a world experiencing a burst of interest in prison and prison breaks. There was a lot of prison-related pop culture in the mid-70s. Steve McQueen's movie Papillon, about a wrongfully incarcerated French safecracker breaking out of jail, had just been released and was a huge hit in Australia. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's expose into the USSR's gulag system was selling millions of copies, which got him stripped of his Soviet citizenship. The movies One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, set in a mental hospital but similarly themed, and Midnight Express, which was a huge hit at the time, but I feel like is now mostly remembered for being referenced in Airplane.
Joey, have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Anyway, both those movies were just a few years out from being released. McNeil's prison dramas were put out into the world at the right time. He became an honest-to-God star, marrying the actress Robin Nevin and hobnobbing with Sydney High Society. Carlson was released in 1976 and began starring in his friend's plays. Unsurprisingly, people noticed Carlson's acting chops. He began playing minor roles in Aussie cop shows. McNeil is still well known enough today that he has a Wikipedia page, not for his crimes, but for his plays. In 1975, his play How Does Your Garden Grow apparently won the Australian Writers Guild's annual award for the best script in any category. Could be a play, a TV episode, a movie, anything. The page doesn't mention his internet-famous prison friend, but a lot of people who were incarcerated alongside Carlson and McNeil, and some who knew them outside, insist that Carlson was the real writer of McNeil's plays. Some of the dialogue does have a Democracy Manifest feel to it. Life seemed to be on the upswing for Carlson and friends. He was out of jail, seemed to have found his calling, didn't have a need or interest in slipping back into a life of crime. He even got married again, to a Yugoslav immigrant named Ivanka Jugum. He called her Eve. Over the latter half of the 70s, they had two children. Things were doing well. And then his wife was murdered. From here, things get really dark. Hearing this story, I understand why Nick Cave is from Australia. This really is a land peopled entirely by criminals. Except that I don't want to create a false impression of Australia here. I've never been, but I do know that really it's extremely safe, at least crime-wise. The spiders, the heat, the drop bears, and being king hit by a dude named Dane in a Bintang singlet will definitely kill you, but people, by and large, won't. In the 1970s, same as now, there were vanishingly few murders in Australia. The strongest evidence I know that antisocial behavior isn't heritable is the fact that today, Australia, a nation founded by convicts, is one of the most peaceful places on earth. Specifically in the state of Victoria, where Melbourne is, only a few people committed more than one murder throughout the 70s, and almost all those people had ties to a guy named Barry Quinn. The nickname of Australia's Charles Manson is one that Quinn may have invented himself, and one that he definitely leaned into. He was crazy, but not Manson-type crazy. He was not a cult leader. He didn't have any strong beliefs, crazy or otherwise. What he had was a strange sort of criminal charisma, and like Manson, he was responsible for many murders, but probably never killed anyone himself. Around 1974, Quinn lived in St. Kilda, a seedy coastal neighborhood of Melbourne that had once been home to the city's theaters and high-end resorts, and had since become Australia's premier red light district. He had stars tattooed on each of his cheeks, in imitation of the cross that Manson carved into his forehead, which he later turned into a swastika, and tattooed love and hate across his knuckles, Night of the Hunter style. Quinn lived with his girlfriend, Cheryl Gardner, and his mistress, 17-year-old Ivanka Jugum. Quinn spent most of his time robbing people at gunpoint for insultingly low amounts of money with a few droog-like male friends. Gardner and Jugum knew all about Quinn's adventures, and about each other, and he knew they knew. In March 1974, Quinn and an unidentified friend robbed a motel, leaving the two people on duty shot in the head. Coincidentally, they too were Yugoslav immigrants. Quinn and his accomplice made off with about 60 Australian dollars, which today would be worth about 600 Australian dollars or 370 US dollars, a staggeringly low sum to be considered worth two lives. It's now believed that Quinn's accomplice, who may have been a small-time criminal named Robert Norman West, was the one who pulled the trigger, and West snitched on Quinn. Either way, Quinn was sentenced to death for the crime, with the police reading out an elaborate and improbable verbal confession. The very next year, the state of Victoria abolished the death penalty, and Quinn's sentence was commuted to life. Barry Quinn never left Eve Jugum's thoughts, even years later when she was married to Jack Carlson. Despite their lives up to this point, Jack and Eve seemed to have a fairly wholesome domestic life together in the late 70s, living in a little resort town on a lake north of Brisbane. Sometimes, Jack's old prison and/or theater friends would come over and Eve would cook for them. And then Barry Quinn came back into their lives. Jack and Eve's daughter Heidi believes the man who killed her mother was one Paul Haig, a man who can really only be described as a cold, psychotic serial killer. In 1978, Haig probably hadn't committed any murders yet, although he had been in and out of jail for various crimes since he was old enough to stand trial. He made his way to St. Kilda in Melbourne, the center of all Australia's criminal underworld by then, where he met Barry Quinn's ex, Cheryl Gardner. She was living with another man then, but she clearly still had eyes only for Quinn. And Haig only had eyes for Cheryl Gardner. It's serial killer love triangle time! Haig confessed his love for Gardner and said he would do anything for her. She said she wanted to break Quinn out of jail, claiming to Haig that it was for his sake and not hers. She said she just wanted Quinn to live a quiet life somewhere out in Western Australia, and insisted that she didn't have feelings for him anymore. But in order to break Quinn out, Haig first had to impress him enough that the word would reach Quinn on the inside. And impress him he sure did. The first few murders Haig committed were clearly attempts at mimicking Quinn's MO. Blowing away random service workers in what police would see as a robbery gone wrong, but was really just an excuse to kill some people. Haig claimed it was to get money that would help break Quinn out of jail, but these stick-ups never netted much money. This wasn't the first horrific crime motivated by getting Quinn out. In 1977, one Ted Eastwood had taken the entire student body of a rural one-room schoolhouse hostage, demanding money, drugs, and the release of Barry Quinn. The hostages escaped and everyone survived unscathed. Quinn clearly cast a strange spell over Australia's criminal underworld. Ultimately, though, it wasn't Haig who would get Quinn out of jail, it was Eve and Jack Carlson, working with Robert Wright, one of Haig's former partners in crime from his early years. As befitting a Jack Carlson escape, the plan was elaborate and unusual. They managed to smuggle in, quote, some stuff, never explained what, that would allow Quinn to fake symptoms of hepatitis. Eve still seemed to be in love with Quinn too at this point, and now Cheryl Gardner hated her. I'm even deliberately leaving out other characters in Dappin's book because they have their own wild stories that aren't too relevant to the main thread. Read the book to learn who Mr. Rent-A-Kill is, for example. The book is literally like this, except that most people involved are horrible, bloodthirsty criminals. Here's a simplified version I drew up of the respective social networks of the succulent Chinese meal guy, Jack Carlson, and the Australian Charles Manson, Barry Quinn, in late 1970s Australia. Somehow, Quinn successfully convinced the prison guards he had hepatitis and was whisked away to a hospital. Eve Carlson came in claiming to be Quinn's girlfriend who had the right to a conjugal visit, and behind a privacy curtain, she stuffed Quinn out the window of the hospital and into the trunk of another accomplice's car. Quinn and Eve camped out for weeks by a lake in the bush, occasionally visited by his friends in the criminal underworld. Carlson was beginning to wonder where his wife was. He headed down to Melbourne to find her. One evening, he was walking down the street in St. Kilda when he got shot in the leg out of a passing car. The wound wasn't life-threatening, nor even leg-threatening, but he suspected Barry Quinn's goons were behind it. Carlson was still wanted in the state of Victoria for crimes back around the time of his not-so-daring island prison escape, so he initially didn't go to the police about the shooting. Now, Carlson didn't really mind the prospect of his wife camping out in the bush, probably fucking her ex, the Australian Charles Manson. By this point, Eve and Jack Carlson were still friends and still stuck up for each other, but the romantic and sexual spark had gone out of their relationship, and they were fine with that. Jack and his old jailhouse theater friends were raising Jack and Eve's two kids, one of whom he named after Jim McNeil. I've heard of pamphlets handed out in gang-heavy neighborhoods in LA that say, "If you go to jail, will the gang raise your kids?" And despite how utterly psychopathic many of the men in this story were, the answer in this 70s Aussie criminal demimonde seems to be yes. Heidi and Jim McNeil Carlson, as far as I can tell, grew up into fairly ordinary middle-aged Aussies, a regular Bruce and Sheila. Neither Jack nor Eve spent much time in jail after they got married, but they were regularly off on adventures with other crims, and in the meantime, it seems like Jim McNeil Sr. and co. raised Heidi and Jim McNeil Carlson just fine. But after a while, Carlson began to realize that this wasn't some lost weekend after which Eve would come back to him. Eve was actually missing. Quinn was caught after 69 days on the run, and pleaded guilty since he knew he had no chance at anything lighter than a life sentence, but Eve was nowhere to be found. Jack had to get the cops involved. Lynn Bowles, another member of this web of lowlifes, led police to the site of where Barry Quinn and Eve Carlson slash Ivanka Jugum had camped. They found human remains, and a ring that Ivanka's mother identified as hers. Astoundingly, as if this was a cheap cop show or a detective board game, they were able to date the murder exactly by finding a bloodstained copy of the November 16th, 1978 issue of the Melbourne Herald. Why did Eve die, and who pulled the trigger? We don't fully know. Again, Heidi Carlson suspects that Paul Haig killed her, which makes sense. He probably knew where Quinn was camping out. He wanted to impress Cheryl Gardner. He was perfectly willing to kill people to impress Cheryl Gardner, and Cheryl Gardner hated Eve. Dappin doubts this, mainly because, just a few months later, Paul Haig killed Cheryl Gardner. Possibly because she knew too much about his other crimes. Years later, Barry Quinn himself confessed to killing Eve Carlson, but he never articulated a motive, somehow simultaneously claiming that they really loved each other up to the end, and nobody who knew him around this time believes him. What the other crims who are still around and willing to talk to Dappin said was that they suspected Gardner herself killed Eve, out of jealousy. In all, dozens of murders like this took place over 1978 and 79 in the state of Victoria. Today, none of them are believed to have been committed by Barry Quinn, but almost all of them were, in some way, committed because of Barry Quinn. Either way, understandably, this finally made Jack Carlson realize that this was not for him. He could live on his own without committing any major crimes from there on out, so he did. He went on the road with his kids Heidi and Jim, staying in various places across Australia for a few months at a time, not necessarily living 100% on the right side of the law. Heidi recalls him getting food for his little family by stealing and butchering a farmer's sheep, one sheep at a time, every week or so, while they were living out in the country at one point. He once decided, on the spur of the moment, to show young Jim how to crack a safe, demonstrating with one at a real estate agency while the employees were distracted. He never intended to steal anything from the safe, but he was, of course, arrested. This was possibly the first time Carlson tried the democracy manifest strategy, making a scene so that he would be received as a lunatic and sent to a mental hospital instead of jail. This time it was a lot ruder, and this time it worked. He egged on the cops into beating him with their nightsticks, and when he was being beaten, he unzipped his pants and began to whip it. Whip it good. Telling the cops to hit him harder, Daddy. Sure enough, Carlson was locked up in a mental institution, which is actually not what they should have done. It's one thing to be crazy, another thing to be kinky. But either way, it was easy to escape from, and that's what Carlson did, with the help of his children. Carlson was also a ladies' man. Heidi and Jim don't know how many half-siblings they have in total, and Carlson probably didn't either. There are probably some people out there in Australia who can quote Democracy Manifest by heart, but have no idea that guy is their dad. He was almost 50 years old when he had the most important succulent Chinese meal of his life. Clearly he thought he was done being arrested, and it was not an arrest that ended up being related to his many escapes from the law. He truly didn't know what the charge was, and probably was surprised and relieved when he realized it really was a case of mistaken identity. It was also, most likely, the last of possibly hundreds of times he got arrested. Carlson's wild criminal past doesn't really have much to do with the legendary arrest in 1991. It was just his suspicious use of multiple names that got him arrested, and his flair for the theatrical that made him a star, both of which are part and parcel of who Jack Carlson was, but didn't necessarily connect to the fact that back in the 70s, he was friends with the most famous prison playwright in Australia and possibly the world, and might even have ghostwritten his plays, and rubbed shoulders with some of the foulest people to ever walk Australia's red dirt. Ultimately, this is less of a criminal rabbit hole and more an expression of the time-honored truth that all Australians know each other. Also, Carlson was a Nazi. I'm sorry about this. It seems to be an annoyingly common theme in these episodes, you know? Here's someone who had a fun, wacky life, maybe they did some bad stuff, but ultimately they were living the dream. Also, by the way, they were a fucking Nazi. Here's a lesbian cult from 1980s Ireland who had a fun, weird, King Victoriana world that they pretended to live in. Also, they were Nazis. Here's a smooth-talking quack doctor who implanted goat testicles into humans, ran for governor of Kansas, and won, but had the election stolen from him, and basically invented the concept of country music as we know it while he was at it. Also, he was probably a Nazi sympathizer. I hate not being able to celebrate slash fetishize funny historical figures who were probably also bad people in other ways. And, honestly, Jack Carlson seems to have been into Nazis in the same way John Brinkley was, as a vibe, rather than an endorsement of their atrocities. John Brinkley had a pool tiled in swastikas, but supported FDR when it came down to it. Jack Carlson once threw a party at his house to commemorate Hitler's birthday, regularly used German-sounding false names, and taught himself German while he was in prison. That's why he was nicknamed the Hun, and had a tendency to just say Heil Hitler to mean something like Hell Yeah or Let's Go, but was willing to tell his life story to a Jewish journalist, Mark Dapin, when it came down to it. It's popular to portray having anything resembling fascist sympathies as the worst crime imaginable, and yeah, if you have a friend who's a Nazi, he's probably the worst person you know, but Jack Carlson hung out with people who had murdered kids for the hell of it, and I honestly think it's worse to kill without any kind of motivating ideology. In comparison, Carlson's worst crimes were a bunch of Looney Tunes-ass escapes. He may have been the most innocent person in his social circles. Carlson died in August 2024, having had his face known across the internet for almost the last two decades of his life, but only receiving credit for it in his final years. The Chinese restaurant where he was arrested still exists at a new location. It's reasonably well reviewed. Many of its reviews subtly include the word succulent. I'll never see this video the same way again, and that's too bad. But now you know what the charge was. Ta-ta, and farewell.
Break your bones. What puts you on your knees? You Hey,